Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 168, recorded Friday, October 16th, 2020. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: quarantine theater and traveling for food. Coming to you from the Travel Commons studios in Chicago, Illinois, after a long weekend of eating and drinking and eating some more with friends that we met up in Philadelphia. It's a family we've traveled with before: South Africa, Singapore, Spain, and now with COVID lockdowns, Philly. And while we'll do a cultural thing or two in the middle of all that, what we really like to do together is eat. It is the kind of group where comments like, okay, we need to stop eating at 1:30 because we have 5:30 reservations, and we're only going to order the half kilo of barbacoa because we'll be eating again in 4 hours. Comments like these are met with, yeah, that's a good point. It makes sense, rather than, I think we have a problem here. In Pennsylvania's reopening regulation about needing to buy food whenever getting a beer, that didn't help either. After sneaking in a cheesesteak right before that 1:30 cutoff, we had to order some food with our afternoon beers. The beer, of course, not subject to the 1:30 deadline because it's liquid, so it's not really food, so it doesn't really count. But when Pennsylvania made us order some real solid food with our beers, we kind of look at the menu, Brussels sprouts. It's a vegetable, right? So it's kind of healthy. 5 minutes later, our beers arrive with a wire basket full of deep-fried Brussels sprouts doused in a sweet chili sauce. So much for that healthy thing. Now, what was fun was that some of the bars in Philly, some of the smaller ones, the neighborhood ones, well, they sort of game that whole system, as these places are wont to do, by putting a $1 food item on the menu. So we had 2 hard-boiled eggs at one bar, a PB&J at another. The best, though, was the Pop-Tart that we had with our last beer at Ray's Happy Birthday Bar in South Philly. That $1 snack, that won the prize. And we found Ray's because we skipped the usual downtown Center City Society Hill hotels and grabbed an Airbnb in South Philly, kind of sandwiched between the older Italian neighborhoods and that newer Little Saigon area. And so that weekend, we spent a lot of time outdoors walking the neighborhoods and walking off our food and stopping in at neighborhood joints. So one day we were picking up salamis and cheese from the Italian market. Another day we're buying banh mi's from a Vietnamese bakery. I'll write up a list of our favorite places for the website in a couple of weeks, kind of similar to what I did at the beginning of the year for places I spent in Phoenix. But I'm going to wait for just a week or so till my cholesterol levels get back to some semblance of normal. So following up, first, a big thank you to Gary Learned, who goes by the Denrail handle on social media, for his review of the Travel Commons Podcast in Apple Podcasts, which used to be iTunes. I don't know what it is anymore. Gary is a longtime Travel Commons listener. Indeed, he's pointed me to some great restaurants in places like Seattle and Memphis. Gary left a great review. He wrote a couple of weeks ago, "When people ask where I live, I usually just say airports in Hilton. As someone who lives the life of the road warrior, I find this podcast strikes an all-too-familiar chord with my own experiences, a definite must-listen to understand the life of the traveler. I wrote the above a number of years ago, and it is as true now as it was then. I look forward to Mark's take on travel. It's more about the journey, and can't count the number of times when I've shook my head, laughed, and said, yep, been there." Well, Gary, thanks very much for that. That was I appreciate those words, and thanks for staying with me this long. Hey, the FBI pushed out a consumer alert last week to remind folks about the risks when using hotel Wi-Fi. Now, we've talked about this many times, and I think most frequent travelers know the drill when accessing any shared Wi-Fi, be it in a hotel or an airport or a bar or Starbucks. Nothing new there, so why the FBI alert? Because, according to the FBI, they have observed a trend where individuals who were previously teleworking from home are beginning to telework from hotels. U.S. hotels, predominantly in major cities, have begun to advertise daytime room reservations for guests seeking a quiet, distraction-free work environment. So, people who used to work in offices and have been working from home since March are looking for a change of scenery, but either can't or aren't keen to go back to the whole group office setting. So enter downtown hotels, many of whom we mentioned last month are sort of slouching toward bankruptcy because of low occupancy. Don't want a bed for the night? How about a desk for the day? Actually, I got an email from Omni Hotels a couple of days ago pitching just that. The copy said, trade up your classroom for everything you need for a productive day of work, plus downtown LA views. I've been in downtown LA and I've never thought of the views as something special, but okay, I'll go with that. I guess the FBI thinks, though, that these displaced office workers used to working on secure corporate or home networks might not be as careful as, say, you know, you and I, frequent travelers who are kind of used to this whole thing. But even for frequent travelers, this FBI alert is a good read, talking about the dangers of an evil twin attack, logging into what looks like a hotel Wi-Fi but is actually a hacker's network, logging into the actual hotel Wi-Fi, which has been compromised through exploits in either out-of-date or unpatched network hardware. So the FBI's top recommendation is one we've repeated numerous times. Use a VPN when you connect to public Wi-Fi, or just avoid them altogether with a mobile hotspot. Now, I have to tell you, even when I've had a corporate VPN, I've actually always used one of the top paid VPN providers. I've used NordVPN, PIA, and ExpressVPN because their software is just so much better. I'm on NordVPN now, and whenever I'm not on a private network, I fire up the Nord client and it handles everything. Connects to the best server, reconnects automatically when I open the lid on my Mac to wake it up again. I don't have to think about it. Indeed, half the time I forget to shut it off at home until I'm wondering why I can't move files to another PC. Also, only use secure websites. I used to say, look for the HTTPS in the URL in the website address bar, but I guess that was too geeky, so you need now to look for lock icons instead. And of course, enable two-factor authentication whenever you can. Nothing new, but this FBI alert is a good reminder nonetheless. I'll put a link to the alert in the show notes, but you can also find a link on the Travel Commons Facebook page and on the Twitter account. Okay, I gotta ask, what happened to Greta Thunberg's fleas scam, or if I'm probably not pronouncing that right, or flight shaming? That was the 2019 existential travel threat that immediately got overwritten by coronavirus. Because I have to tell you, this whole Asian thing of flights to nowhere, so EVA Air from Taiwan filling up its Hello Kitty plane, Air Nippon doing a fake flight to Hawaii, and then Qantas selling out a 787 for a lap around Australia. I mean, Singapore Air scrapped their flight to nowhere at the last minute, instead turning turning one of their Airbus A380s into a pop-up restaurant. I got to tell you that, honestly, I just don't get this. I mean, for me, a flight is a means to an end, something I got to bear to get where I want to go. Getting on that 737 in O'Hare last week to go to Philadelphia did not fill me with joy. It was just simple math, 2 hours in a plane versus 11 hours in a car. And all that I've just said goes double for the idea of voluntarily buying airplane meals to eat at home. Words just fail me on that one. At the end of September, the CDC did an early release of an article slated for the November issue, so next month's issue, of their peer-reviewed journal, Emerging Infectious Diseases. And I thought Walden Pond was a cure for insomnia. But anyhow, the article analyzed the in-flight transmission of coronavirus from one business class passenger to 14 other passengers and a crew member on a 10-hour Vietnam Air flight from London to Hanoi. Now, most of the reactions in the press and on Twitter were, yikes, single passenger infects 15 people. Now, while noting the CDC's disclaimer, early release articles are not considered as final versions, that disclaimer I didn't see mentioned anywhere in any of the press articles, I actually came away, after I read through the whole thing, I came away with a less than yikes reading. Now, the flight was on March 2nd, so while the world was still trying to figure out this whole novel coronavirus thing, and way before mandatory in-flight masks. And the passenger was symptomatic with a cough and a sore throat. And of the 14 passengers infected, 12 were in the same business class cabin. And of those, all but two were within a two-seat radius. The authors aren't sure if the two economy class infections were from that business class passenger, the index case, or from a different source. So my takeaways, number one, don't let symptomatic people on the planes. Even if temperature checks aren't perfect, it might catch some folks and certainly make people think about their condition before flying because, two, the study appears to validate the risk of being kept in close proximity to an infected person over a prolonged period, which, three, justifies to me the airline's no excuses mask requirements, but four, in spite of a symptomatic unmasked passenger coughing away in the front of the plane, no non-adjacent passengers got infected. So maybe the airline exec's confidence in HEPA filters is kind of justified. I'll put a link in the show notes to the CDC paper. It's not that long. It's actually an interesting read, and it's good, I think, to read source documents rather than just rely on headlines or short USA Today blurbs. Having said that, I'm in no way, shape, or form justifying the hygiene theater that the travel industry seems to be trying to use to get folks back. I talked back in the July episode about the Hertz Gold Standard Clean sticker that Hertz is slapping across driver's side doors. And there are now some hotels that are scheduling cleaning during the day, kind of lobby cleaning and common area cleaning. They're scheduling it during the day rather than overnight so that guests can actually see them cleaning. And then, and this one tops it, on my American flights between Chicago and Philly last week, the banner across the top of the American Way magazine cover in the seat back pocket said, "This magazine has been treated with a microbial process," which I guess means, please feel safe to open up this magazine and look at the advertisements. We need the money. I don't know. It kind of feels a little bit like security theater that we all went through after 9/11. It's less about actually making things safer and more actually about making us feel safer and so more willing to get on a plane. Now, maybe if I'm an airline or hotel exec facing down the pain of laying off thousands or tens of thousands of people if travelers don't come back, that distinction between actual and feel is kind of meaningless. They're just trying to survive. And hey, if you have any travel stories, comments, questions, tips, rants, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio comments to comments, COMMENTS, travelcommons.com. You can send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page or the Instagram account at Travel Commons, or you can always post the comments on the website at travelcommons.com. The first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is quarantine theater. Now, while some folks in the hospitality industry are talking about hygiene theater, like I just mentioned, what about quarantine theater? Now, back in the August episode, I talked about the complexity that local and state travel bans and quarantine measures are causing on people trying to plan some sort of travel. My son Andrew and his significant other headed out to Portland, Maine last month for work. The week before they left, the Marriott emailed him a form saying, "Please certify one of the following is true. One, I have received a negative COVID test performed no later than 72 hours prior to my arrival, or two, will quarantine for 14 days upon my arrival in Maine. Well, since the trip was only going to be 4 days, they trundled down to the nearest testing site for a quick test 2 days before they left, where, actually, they got chewed out by one of the testers. The tester said, "We're running out of quick tests. You should have planned better." Well, okay, how long to get the results from the other test? 5 days. But that won't meet Maine's 3-day requirement. The tester just walked away. But at the end of it, they got their negative test results and got on a plane to Portland, where no one at the airport or the hotel asked to see it. Okay, no harm done other than the discomfort of a Q-tip probing their sinuses and a random bit of yelling, but why waste scarce testing resources? Now, the Chicago quarantine is also a bit of kabuki theater. I mean, once a week, the city's health commissioner gets in front of the press to scold another state or two. This week was Indiana and Wisconsin. There's now 25 states and Puerto Rico that if you're traveling from there to Chicago, you're supposed to self-quarantine for 14 days or face fines up to $7,000. Now, more interesting is that Chicago's threshold for getting on this list is 15 new daily cases per 100,000 residents, you know, averaged out over a, kind of a rolling average of 7 days. Now, in this week's tally, Indiana is running in the 20 to 30 new daily cases per 100,000 residents range. But so is the state of Illinois. You could call it hypocritical about Chicago blanking out Indiana but not Illinois, or pragmatic, or keeping its powder dry for when the city needs another bucket of money from the state. But Chicago is just not going to put the rest of Illinois on its quarantine list. Now, I've actually yet to hear of anyone who has actually self-quarantined, and as of last week, press reports say that nobody has actually been rung up with a fine for not doing so. But last month, a friend told me about how Chicago's quarantine theater hit her. She finally got around to taking some vacation at the end of the summer. She lives in Chicago, but she's a big outdoors person. So looking at airfares and tossing some darts at a map, she decided to go hike in Bryce Canyon and Zion National Parks down in southern Utah. She's down there for a couple of days when her boss calls her. Boss says, "They've just announced that Utah is going on the city's quarantine list. It's not official until Friday, so I guess if you get out of there by Thursday, you won't have to quarantine for 2 weeks before coming back to work." Well, and it didn't need to be said, those 2 weeks of self-quarantine wouldn't be paid. My friend is unique in that she works for maybe the one company in Chicago that I've heard of taking the city's quarantine order seriously. So she fought through lousy cell coverage down in southern Utah to see what she could salvage of the back half of her vacation. Luckily, she's got friends who live up in Oregon, which isn't on the city's list. So Thursday, she cuts her hiking short, schleps the 4.5 hours back up to Salt Lake City Airport, and catches the last flight out to Portland, which let her come back to work and make some money the next week when she returned. Now, theater isn't a new thing. If you're, say, call us a mature traveler, I'm right there. You kind of got to play a bit part in the security theater that premiered after 9/11 and the underwear bomber incident. While not a perfect analogy, and really nothing ever is, we could see some of the similar theatrics, government agencies, TSA then, health departments now, investing in activities that signal they're serious, but that most folks know aren't really effective. I mean, for me, and I think for most frequent travelers, the security theater ended with TSA PreCheck. It seemed, again, to most of us, that it was a reasonable balance between risk and getting on with our traveling lives. I don't know what the endpoint looks like for quarantine theater. I don't know. Maybe a certificate of vaccination that some people have talked about. Whatever it is, I sure hope it doesn't take the 10 years it took to figure out PreCheck.
Release is required. Release. Release is required.
The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is traveling for food. Now, I talked at the start of the episode about eating my way through Philadelphia a couple of weeks back, and it was just that. We landed Thursday at Philadelphia Airport around 11:30 in the morning, and we were hitting our faves at Reading Terminal Market by 1:30 in the afternoon. I went straight for Tommy Dinnick's for the roast pork sandwich with a sharp provolone and broccoli rabe, while Irene and Claire made first for the Mennonite pretzel place, and then over to Termini Brothers for fresh-filled cannolis. And then as we were leaving, I swung past one of the Pennsylvania Dutch meat stands, butcher stands, to buy a one-pound block of scrapple for the rest of the breakfasts during my stay. Great thing about an Airbnb, you can cook your own breakfast. Now, back in the August episode, in the interview with Emily Thomas about her book, The Meaning of Travel, we talked about a chapter on global homogenization. Now, one of the bits that I edited out for time was sort of my observation that back 10 to 20 years ago, it was fun to go shopping in new places and bring something unique back home. But now, with globalized e-commerce, there's not much that you can't find easier and often cheaper on, say, Amazon or Taobao or Rakuten. And so for me, food is kind of the one experience of a place that can't be easily exported and bought online. And no, buying frozen deep dish pizza does not count. On our trip to the UP, Michigan's Upper Peninsula, for those of you not in the Midwest, now, along with the hiking and biking and kayaking, we also did a bit of a pasty tasting tour. Now, you might say, which one came first, the pasty tasting tour causing the need for the hiking, biking, and kayaking, or the other way around, a little bit of a chicken and the egg. The UP is pretty well known, again, in the Midwest, for their pasties brought over by Cornish miners who were working in the copper mines around the turn of the century. Now, we had a lot of traditional pasties, primarily, which are filled with steak and potatoes and onions and rutabagas, obviously all wrapped in a pastry, so kind of like a meat hand pie. But then there were also breakfast pasties. Now, we ended up working our way through the finer points of pasty critique, picking out the pasties made from lard-based doughs, a bit flakier, and then the folks who had the fillings that held together so that you could eat the pasty with your hand. The stuff wasn't kind of tumbling out on your shirt, but there was some texture there, and they weren't all complete mush. It's funny how these sort of comparison dishes can crop up on vacation. On a trip to Phuket, Thailand, Andrew ordered pad thai everywhere we ate. On a trip to Hungary, Irene searched every menu for halászlé, a spicy fish soup, after having a great bowl of it at lunch with her cousin in some little town on the shores of Lake Balaton. And again, Irene, in Spain now, searched every city we visited for salmorejo. Not quite a soup, but more of a tomato and bread and olive and garlic puree. And these sort of horizontal tastings, some were planned, like our pasty tour, and some would just sort of come up, like Irene's halászlé hunt. But it'd be fun getting a feel for what the base of the dish is, what everybody agrees on, and then what people put their own spin on. Because usually for these sort of core dishes that everyone around has eaten all their lives, they've all got an opinion about them, and that's part of what makes that sort of that broad, that horizontal tasting fun. And also, these dishes don't seem to kind of take to being industrialized. Now, while I've had some mass-produced pasties in the UK, grabbing something out of the West Cornish pasty hut in Waterloo Station while running for a train, the pasties in the UP were much more, I don't want to say artisanal, because I don't think anyone making pasties in the UP would use that word, but they were family-made at Miner's Pasties in Munising, which actually came out top in our pasty place rankings. The woman helping us at the counter said the lard pastry recipe came from the owner's grandmother, and only three people know it, the granddaughters and their niece, and only those three people make the pastry every day. We just sat back and enjoyed those pasties because, A, we really liked them, and B, we knew we wouldn't be eating them again unless and until we find our way back again to that bench someday. Okay, that's it. That is the end of Travel Commons podcast number 168. I hope you all enjoyed the show and hope you decide to stay subscribed and keep listening. A quick program note, I'm going to be doing a bit of renovation work in the Travel Commons infrastructure, so you may see a bit of dust flying. I'm starting with the RSS feed. That's the file that podcast apps read when they're trying to find episodes and new episodes. I don't know, for those of you who've been around podcasting long enough, remember back when Adam Curry tried to get everyone to call those apps podcatchers? Well, anyhow, so some of that RSS cleanup may trigger some podcast apps to re-download episodes. I started tweaking the RSS feed a couple of weeks ago, and Jim McDonough sent me a tweet saying that Downcast had reloaded the September episode. I'm not changing any back episodes, just the RSS feed, so I apologize in advance for causing any extraneous downloads. After that, I'll be revamping the Travel Commons website. I haven't changed it since 2006, so I thought it was time for a fresh coat of paint. Again, if this sparks any weird reactions in podcast apps, I apologize in advance. As we've always said, you can find the Travel Commons podcast on SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn, Alexa, iTunes, or Apple Podcast, I guess it is, Spotify, and Amazon Music. The links, along with that soon-to-be-reworked RSS feed, are on the right-hand side of the current Travel Commons website under the heading Subscribe. Right below that in the social media section, links to the Travel Commons Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram feeds. Definitely going to be working to make these links more prominent on the new site. And if you've already subscribed, how about leaving us a review on one of those sites like Gary did? Really appreciate that. And always, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along. Text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, and Peacock on Twitter. Write them on the Travel Commons Facebook page or the Travel Commons Instagram site, or post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken time to send in emails, tweets, and posts. Comments on the website. I really appreciate it. And as always, thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Safe travels for those of you who can get out. And until we talk again, take care. Bye now.